Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
So, welcome to the second Saki on Sabbatical myth-busting World War II episode, or part, I guess. I think this is actually only going to be one part. Guaranteed to be controversial. I'm probably going to lose a lot of friends with this one. I'm hoping that it triggers a debate and some comments. So what I'm going to do in this episode is myth-busting the use of the atomic bomb on Japan. And guess what? I'm going to be controversial, and I'm going to explain, actually, why the use of the atomic bomb was justified. So I'm not going to go through, like, the reasons why the bomb shouldn't have been used, because I suspect most of you out there have your reasons for why the bomb shouldn't have been used. I'm going to just go straight into why the use of the atomic bomb was justified, I guess, given the circumstances, which is something we often forget, historians or observers sitting here in 2019, going back to 1945 or 1944 or 1943, and judging what was done using 2019 arguments, when really what we should be trying to do is place ourselves in their situation, the decision-maker situation at the time in 1945 specifically. And if you do it that way, it turns out that maybe the United States, again, given the circumstances, it may have been justified to use the atomic bomb, and even to use it twice. So that's what this episode is going to be all about. And like I said, it's probably only going to be one episode. Could be two parts, rather. So I'll just get right into it. Okay, so let me take you back to 1945, very briefly. The United States had been fighting a war with Japan since 1941. Up until 1945, when the bomb is actually dropped in August. That fighting had been absolutely brutal. I know in the last episode we spoke about what it was like on the Eastern Front and on both sides, you know, the Russians and the Germans. But what's interesting about the Eastern Front is that both sides actually knew that they were, you know, doing something wrong, especially the Germans. They were trying to hide what was going on, what they were doing. They were trying to hide the evidence, so to speak. In the case of Japan, the brutality is comparable to what we saw on the Eastern Front on the part of the Germans and the Russians. But what's particularly disturbing, I guess, when you look at the Japanese is that they were actually proud of what they were of what they were doing. Let me give you an example: the raping of Nanking. There was news reports back home in Japan where they were reporting, you know, the amount of Chinese heads that were being chopped off by the Japanese soldiers. And at one point, there was, like, this competition between these two Japanese dudes over, you know, who was, like, chopping off more heads. And this stuff was being played out in the newspapers in Japan. There's also this famous picture of an Australian soldier who is, whose head's being chopped off. You can look it up in internet. What you see is the soldier on his hands and knees, bending over forwards, and the Japanese soldier, the Japanese officer, standing right next to him with his sword pulled back, ready to go down. The only reason we have a picture, the only reason we actually have that picture, is because that Japanese officer asked, I guess, one of his buddies if he could take a picture of him while he was chopping the head over the, while he was chopping the head of a Australian soldier. So the Japanese weren't necessarily upset about what they were doing, especially with respect to the Chinese. They were advertising. The level of brutality also in terms of the fighting with the Americans and the Japanese, probably pretty close to what happened on the Eastern Front on both sides here. You know, the Japanese had this rule which they actually literally did apply, which was, you know, they would fight to the last man. The Germans weren't stupid. When they started realizing that things were going bad, like in the case of Stalingrad, or in the case of certain areas of Normandy, the Germans would surrender, and they would surrender en masse in the thousands. Entire German units would surrender. Whereas in the case of Japanese, you did have Japanese soldiers surrendering, but what's notable about the Japanese was you never actually had a unit, like let's say a platoon surrender, or a battalion or anything like that. It was individual Japanese soldiers. It was really a question of honor. They had been sent there to fight on behalf of the emperor. The emperor was considered a god. There's this other story that I heard where a mother sees off her son go to war, a Japanese mother seeing off her son to go to war, gives him this little dagger, and he says, you know, just in case you're about to be captured by the Americans, to use the dagger to harikiri yourself, you know, to commit suicide. I mean, what mother would give their son a dagger to commit suicide? I mean, I don't know, but I know my mom, and my mom would say, like, you know what, the first chance you can, surrender, which is, I guess, a little hard, makes it a little bit hard to understand how a Japanese mother could possibly tell her son to commit suicide. And don't get all social constructivist on me and start saying that, well, you know, that's Japanese culture and we have to kind of understand what they believed in. Give me a fucking break. I mean, mothers should not be giving their sons daggers to commit suicide. So when the Americans hooked up with the Japanese in actual ground combat, specifically the so-called island hopping, the Americans, they went from island to island to island as they were moving northwards to get as close as possible to Japan. The plan being, of course, to ultimately invade the Japanese homeland. This is obviously before the bomb they determine that the bomb is successful. So they're doing this island hopping, and the fighting was just brutal. Like I said, the Japanese wouldn't surrender, and or those that would surrender, they would surrender with, like, you know, grenades all over them. So when they would surrender, they'd, you know, pull the grenade and suicide bomber kind of thing. And the Americans quickly learned that take no prisoners. I mean, the reason they did this was, you know, this no prisoner policy is a result of, well, the suicide bombing activities that the Japanese were infamous for. I mean, you've heard, of course, of the Japanese pilots who would fly their planes into American combat vessels. So don't underestimate, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about what the fighting was like in Europe, but honestly, I mean, what happened in the Pacific and what was going on in the Pacific was pretty damn brutal as well. There was, of course, quite a bit of racism on the part of the Americans with respect to the Japanese. I have to admit that. A lot of the cartoons that you see from the period are racially derogatory of the Japanese. It's interesting that they had these derogatory cartoons of the Japanese. The Yellow Man, right? They had these derogatory cartoons about the Japanese, but they didn't have them as far as the Germans were concerned. So I guess it was a little easier, is what I'm trying to say, to kill Japanese, because they looked down on them. Whereas most American soldiers in Europe hadn't really honestly met a German until 1944, until D-Day. There was the operation in North Africa and in Italy right after. In a way, the Americans really don't learn to hate the Germans in the same way that they came to hate the Japanese. Now, I'm not trying to say that this is in any way a kind of a justification for the use of the atomic bomb. I'm trying to give you a picture of what's like going on in 1945. Now, here's where the justification, or let's say the justification for the use of the atomic bomb comes in. And I guess I'll break this up into different reasons, I guess, or different justifications for the war. The first one is that right about the time the war ends in Europe, in April of 1945, the Americans are preparing for a conventional land invasion of Japan itself, sort of like a D-Day, but in a much larger scale. Obviously, the plan was MacArthur is the general who's in charge of the Pacific Theater. The plan was that they were going to take these soldiers that had just finished fighting in Europe for the last 2 years, and they were going to use them for an invasion of Japan. Now, honestly, if try to put yourself back in 1945, you're a soldier in the 82nd Airborne Division or the 101st Airborne Division, and the Germans have just surrendered, and they ask you this question. You get to decide. Either you go fight in Japan a conventional war against an enemy that is apparently much more brutal than the Germans were, or the other option is that you get to go home and hang out with your wife or your mom and dad or whatever. A lot of these were young kids still. What do you think these guys would answer? I think the answer is pretty freaking obvious. So again, you need to emphasize this idea that we need to look at the decision to use the atomic bomb, or the use of the atomic bomb, has to be seen with 1945 eyes, not 2019 eyes. Let's pose the same question to an American mother in some farm in Iowa. You know, we have a weapon that will probably lead to the immediate surrender of the Japanese, but we're not going to use it, ma'am. What we're going to do is we're going to send your son instead, who just finished fighting in Europe. We're going to send him over to Japan to invade the Japanese islands. So again, what do you think that mom from Iowa would say to something like that? It's important to note that in anticipation of the actual conventional land and D-Day style land invasion of the Japanese islands, MacArthur ordered 1 million body bags. Now, of course, they weren't expecting to lose 1 million soldiers. A lot of these body bags were going to be for Japanese losses as well. But the Americans were really calculating that the taking of the Japanese islands was going to extend the war to 1947 approximately, and that in terms of lost American lives, they were kind of calculating close to 500,000, maybe a little bit more, right around 500,000 American losses to take the Japanese islands, because the Japanese were very different from the Germans. When the Germans realized, now I'm not talking about the Nazis here, I'm talking about the Germans, when the Germans started realizing that the war was not going too well for them, they started to surrender en masse. there was no reason for the Americans to expect the Japanese to surrender en masse, just like the Germans did, because the experience that the Americans had had in this island hopping operation that I just mentioned a few moments ago was that the Japanese don't surrender. And the emperor had given orders to the population to fight to the last man, woman, and child. And there was every expectation that that would occur, given the fanatic following that the emperor had in Japan. So D-Day was going to be, or D-Day and what happened after D-Day, you know, the Falaise and Market Garden and the Battle of the Bulge and so forth. The expectation was that that was going to be like, you know, peanuts, a cakewalk compared to what an actual invasion of Japan would look like. The Americans were really expecting to take very heavy losses. Now, not only that, and I'm not trying to say that the Americans were thinking about this in any significant way. I mean, I'm sure somebody mentioned it somewhere along the way. But in the process of conventionally overthrowing the Japanese government, a lot of Japanese were going to die. Because again, the order from the emperor was fight to the last man, woman, and child. So a conventional invasion of Japan would in all likelihood have cost the Japanese a lot more lives. And this includes civilians. And I mention this because a lot of people make the argument that, well, you know, I mean, when you drop the bomb, you drop the bomb on non-combatants or on civilians. Yes, absolutely. But again, context, right? The expectation on the part of the Americans, and there was a lot of evidence to support this, was, in fact, that those civilians were going to take up weapons and fight the Americans if the Americans landed, or when the Americans landed in Japan. So I'm not saying that that means that, you know, an 8-year-old child is a combatant. I'm just trying to emphasize this idea of the fanatic nature of this loyalty that the Japanese had towards the emperor, again, because they considered him to be a god. You know, the other thing we got to remember, and I guess this is the second point here, is, and again, it's all about, you know, trying to put yourself back in 1945 and think about what people and decision makers were thinking at the time. All sides, Americans, Japanese, Russians, Germans, they were in an arms race to build better, more effective, meaning more destructive, weapons in order to end the war favorably. Practically every single rule was broken in the Second World War. If you had it, you use it. I mean, there is absolutely no incentive for a country to develop a technology, and this is something that, you know, applies to the Germans, applies to the Russians, applies to, of course, to the Americans. If you have the technology, you're going to use it because your primary objective is to end the damn war as soon as possible. Remember, these countries had been at war for 5-6 years, some of them more in the case of China and Japan, and everyone was looking for a way to end the war as soon as possible. So putting yourself, I mean, doing that thing that I said where you put yourself back in 1945, either as just a regular citizen or a decision maker, your priority is to end the war as soon as possible. And if you have a weapon that you think might end that war, you're going to use it. Now, of course, to us in 2019, we don't think that. But the reason we don't think it, not because we're better in any way, it's because we haven't gone through 6 years of war. 70 million people were killed, at least 70, we won't really ever know how many people were killed, but 70, 80 million people were killed in this war. And now you're going to ask a country that has developed a new technology to not use that technology, which might end the war? You can't apply 2019 mentality to 1945 mentality. It's unfair because we're not going through what these people went through. We're not going through what that mother in Iowa went through with her three sons at the war. And we're not going through what Truman or Roosevelt or Churchill or Stalin, or let's admit it, even we're not, Hitler was going through. You know, Hitler developed the V2 bomb, the V2 missile, which he thought was going to be the miracle weapon to end the war favorably for Nazi Germany. It didn't turn out that way because they just couldn't produce enough of them, but they used it. It's like you have the technology, you use the technology because you want to end the war, of course, favorably. So another way to look at this is to say to yourself, imagine you, Mr. or Miss or whatever, 2019, having a conversation with somebody in 1945 and saying, you know, there are really significant ethical issues involved in the decision as to whether or not to employ or deploy a nuclear weapon. And the 1945 person looks back at you and says, what the fuck? I don't give a shit. What is this ethics, morality? I want the war to fucking end. And if this is going to end the goddamn war quickly, deploy it. I don't give a shit about ethics. What, you're telling me we have this, like, huge motherfucking bomb that can, like, fucking end the war in a matter of, like, days, and I'm not going to use it because of ethics? What the hell's wrong with you? Ethics? 70 million people have been killed. We've been fighting a war for, like, 5 years. And whatever we have, drop it on them. And you know what? Drop it twice. Just to make sure. Which is what they did. My point here is that things had gotten so bad and so deadly during the Second World War that any side, every side, was scrounging to try to figure out how to make some kind of technological advancement. The Americans with the atomic bomb, the Germans with jet fighters, some kind of technological advancement that's going to end the war. Nobody, not anywhere on the planet was anybody thinking about the ethical or moral implications of any of the weapon systems that were being deployed. You know, people mention Hiroshima and Nagasaki as appalling examples of what happened in the Second World War, but they forget to mention that the United States and Great Britain did equally, if not worse, damage to Germany and Austria and the rest of the Axis powers, just with conventional weapons. The Second World War, just like any other war, had a significant technological race aspect to it, whose purpose was to try to figure out how to design the most vicious, deadly weapons you possibly can design in order to end the war, favorably, of course, as soon as possible. That's what ethics, or I'm sorry, that's what morality is at that time. Let's get better weapons, and let's use them, and let's figure out how to end this damn thing as soon as possible. And if it means that we have to, You know, drop a couple of bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Well, no problem. Nobody really had any kind of ethical qualms about using the bomb, including Oppenheimer, who, after seeing what the bomb actually did, decided that he was going to be an anti-nuclear proliferation activist, anti-nuclear weapons proliferation activist. But at the time that he was working on the Manhattan Project, he didn't have any issues. In fact, when the bomb was dropped, you know, you'd expect from 2019 eyes to be looking at news reports and saying to yourself, oh my God, what just happened? Alternatively, what was happening in the United States and in Great Britain was people were celebrating. People were smiling. They were happy that this had happened. It's not that they're evil. It's that it's a different context. It's a 1945 context. And we're trying to judge this context using 2019 eyes. It's just not going to work. And it also isn't fair, because we weren't there. Okay, so like I'm triggered now, right? So screw ethics, right? Screw ethics. Well, maybe not so fast. Because we know for a fact that if the Americans would have invaded, a conventional invasion, D-Day style, that it would have cost the Americans hundreds of thousands of lives. They were estimating, like I mentioned earlier, between 300,000 to 500,000 just in American lives lost. But then there's also the multitude in the millions, probably, of Japanese lives that would have been lost if the Americans invaded, because, as I mentioned earlier, the Japanese were going to fight to the last man, woman, and child, and grandmother. And we know they were going to fight, because, I mean, honestly, what mother gives their son a dagger and says, you know, if you're gonna get caught by the Americans, you know, do a Harry Caray and commit suicide, or alternatively, you know, when you're sending home pictures from the war, ordinarily you send home pictures of you and your buddies having lunch or something like that. Nope, not in the case of the Japanese. They're sending home pictures of who's cutting off more heads. Look, Mom, I'm just about to cut off a head. Be proud. They were going to fight not only the Japanese army, but they were going to fight Japanese civilians. In other words, Japanese civilians, if a landing had taken place, would have been converted from non-combatants into combatants. And who knows how millions would have died. Now, I'm not saying that the Americans dropped the bomb in order to save American and Japanese lives. Of course not. They were only interested in saving those American lives that would have been lost and to shorten the war. However, unintended consequence, I guess, let's say, of the dropping of the atomic bomb was that in all likelihood, millions of Japanese lives were probably saved. Now, one of the criticisms that is leveled against, I guess, the United States and its use of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that they, they targeted civilians. Well, first of all, that wasn't the first time civilians were being targeted. But secondly, and I think much more importantly, the point that I just made a few moments ago, which was that once the Americans had landed, in all likelihood, these civilians would no longer be civilians. They would actually be combatants. Now, another point. People often, you know, say, well, why the two bombs? Why did they have to drop the two bombs? And there's like a whole bunch of conspiracy theories about why the Americans wanted to drop the two bombs, because they wanted to test the two different types of systems that they had developed in the two different atomic bomb, the two different atomic bombs that they were trying to send a signal to the Soviets. Well, maybe on the one on the Soviets, actually, they were probably trying to send at least partly a signal to the Soviets. But honestly, the Japanese didn't surrender after the first bomb. And well, then, you know, people come back and say, well, you know, they didn't give enough time, right? It was only like 3 days. Actually, we know that the Japanese high command meant immediately after the dropping of the bomb on the first bomb on Hiroshima, and and they said, they determined that the United States only had one bomb, and that they were therefore not going to surrender. So this meeting did take place. This is not, I mean, you can just look this up. There's no conspiracy theory crap going on here, okay? The Japanese took a decision after Hiroshima to not drop, to not surrender, which kind of proves the point about how the Japanese were willing to sacrifice civilian lives willy-nilly in order to win the war. Oh, and a little correction here. It's not that the Japanese high command was willing to sacrifice the lives of civilians in order to win the war, so to speak, you know, in the way that Hitler had a policy of, like, no surrender, and a lot of these Germans were like, I want to surrender, but I can't. Or, I want to surrender, and I will, and I don't give a crap what Hitler says. That actually happened quite a bit, too. Now, here, there's no pressure on the part of the government in order to get these civilians to go out and fight. They want to fight. They want to fight for the emperor. The emperor is a god. So now we get to the head honcho, the guy who ultimately made the decision. The guy was famous for having a little plaque on his desk that said, "The buck stops here, President Truman." Truman was of course the man who decided to deploy the weapons, President Harry S. Truman. And you know, from my perspective, this is probably, or the way I see it, this is probably the hardest decision any single individual has ever had to make. Truman knew how destructive the weapon was. Truman, in fact, was happy, elated, in fact, with the success of the weapons when they were actually deployed. But Truman had to carry the emotional burden of being responsible for the almost instantaneous death of approximately 100,000 people, 50,000 in Hiroshima and about another 50,000 in Nagasaki. Now, again, trying to put ourselves back to 1945. Let's try to put ourselves in the shoes of Harry S. Truman and what he's thinking and what he must be thinking. This man has a weapon that he knows is obviously very destructive. There is a consensus in the United States that in all likelihood it will end the war quickly, and of course therefore the Japanese version of D-Day will not need to take place. So whenever I think about Truman and the decision to drop the bomb, I always say to my students that imagine if, like in 1948, right, it got out in public opinion that the United States had a weapon that could have ended the war in 1945. But instead, President Truman decided to not use it for some kind of ethical reason. The weapon was just too destructive to use. I mean, not only, forget about his political career. I mean, can you imagine what people, U.S. citizens, would have done to him? They would have literally lynched the man. I mean, can you imagine what this, you had the weapon that could have ended the war and could have saved the lives of, I don't know, 100,000, 50,000, 500,000 Americans, and you chose not to use it? I mean, his life would be in danger. So, again, when we're judging the, or when we're thinking about the use of the weapon, you have to put yourself back in 1945. And on this specific, on the specific decision to use the bomb, you have to put yourself in the shoes of President Harry S. Truman. Honestly, there was no other option for him. There was absolutely no other option for him. So It's 1945. You're Harry S. Truman. They've just tested the bomb. It works. What would you do? And I'm asking you specifically, the audience of the podcast. What would you do? Why don't you write to me, telling me what you would do at the email address of the podcast, which is securityperimeter@gmail.com, and tell me what you would do if you were Harry S. Truman in 1945. I'm really interested in what you have to say. And maybe we can do a bit of a survey as far as reactions are concerned, and then I can tell you, you know, what the results are in the next podcast. So, honestly, ask yourself, I mean, if you were Harry S. Truman in 1945, what would you do? And be honest, given the information that I've shared with you. I remember in my history class a couple of years ago, I was giving this precise class on the atomic bomb, and near the end of the class, I turned over and I saw one of my female students who had become teary-eyed. And I asked her, what's wrong? Have I upset you in any way? And she said, no, it's just that when you asked the question, what would you do if you were president of the United States? I thought to myself that, yeah, I think I would actually drop the bomb, and that it upset her so much that she believed that she had to make that horrible decision. So I'll close out this, I guess, second installment of myth-busting World War II with one more anecdote, I guess. I remember having this discussion, with a Japanese friend. And obviously you can imagine how that was going. And then it occurred to me that if there would have been a conventional invasion, one of the things that had been agreed upon by the big three, the United States, Soviet Union, and Great Britain, but specifically the United States and Great Britain, was that the way it would work would be that, you know, the United States would come in from the south, they would land from the south, and the Soviets would land from the north. And there would be, of course, a protracted conventional ground combat that would probably, as we said in the beginning of the podcast, gone on till about 1947. But something interesting probably would have happened as a result of that. In the way that Korea was separated into two countries, North Korea and South Korea, as a result of the end of the Second World War and or the beginning of the Cold War, the likelihood that the same thing would have happened in Japan seems to me to be pretty high. In other words, you would have had the same kind of split of the country, north belonging to the Soviets and south belonging to the Americans, and Japan would be today maybe where Korea is today. And when I mentioned that to the Japanese friend of mine, that individual was like, oh, okay, I hadn't thought of that one. So, in a way, and I know this sounds awfully creepy, and I'm going to finish up this episode with this, is that by dropping the bomb, the Americans made sure that the Soviets didn't invade, and therefore result in the splitting of the country into two, and having half of Japan's population starving under an oppressive regime, just like Kim Il-sung, or Kim Jong-il, or one of the Kims, Kim Il-sung, I don't know where, I remember which one, the Kim one is right now, But you get my idea. It's a strange way of thinking about it, but yeah, I mean, there is a possibility that the United States saved Japan by dropping the atomic bomb. Oh my God, I can't believe I just said that. I'm going to shut my mouth now. It's the end of the episode, and I hope I still have friends after this episode. Well, not that I actually really had any friends before, but this one I'm hoping is going to get some reaction by some of you listeners out there. So if you want to react to it, if you want to add to it, if you want to correct me, if you think or if you believe or if you found something that's some kind of inaccuracy in any way, please email the podcast at securityperimeter@gmail.com. So the podcast's email account is securityperimeter@gmail.com. And I'll see you next week with another myth-busting World War II. Next week, the idea is to start the myth-busting that the Nazis were these great military strategists, when they actually were pretty bad. See you later. Hey, out there on your own, sitting naked by the phone, would you touch me? Hey, you, with your ear against the wall, waiting for someone to call out, would you touch me? To help me to carry the stone. Open your heart, I'm coming home. Thank you.